kind of victims of our own success. We weren't really exposed to the virus. We were sheltering in place. We were working at home. We could afford to work at home. And now with highly transmissible variants, it's not working as much. But one would say that we did it at the right time. And now with all these tools, we can probably engage in life knowing how to protect ourselves.
UC San Francisco infectious disease specialist Dr. Peter Chin Hong talking about the rise of COVID cases in the Bay Area over the weekend. The case rate there has nearly doubled in the last week and is the worst in the state right now. Here in L.A., we're in better shape, but cases are going up quickly. L.A. County reported more than 12,000 new cases between Saturday and Monday. Hospitalizations are also going back up. Here to talk about this is L.A. Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer. Welcome back to Press Play.
Oh, thanks so much for having me today, Madeline.
So the numbers are going up. What's your reaction to that?
No, it's unfortunate. Nobody ends up in the hospital unless they get infected. So when you have as much transmission as we're having, we increase the odds of people getting really sick, ending up in the hospital. And tragically, some of the people in the hospital we know pass away. Our numbers are higher than they've been really since early February now. You know, over the weekend, we saw about 12,000 new cases. Test positivity remains relatively, modest, but has doubled in the last month. And we've seen almost 80% increase in hospitalizations in the last month. None of this is good news for us because it really means that we're creating additional risk. And that's particularly bad news for people who are more vulnerable because either they have a lot more exposures during the day or because they are older or because they have underlying health conditions. But the name of the game really is to reduce that risk.
Mm-hmm. So are you considering reimposing an indoor mask mandate?
Well, we don't want to go there at all. And the threshold for going there is quite high. We would have to be seeing stress on the healthcare system as defined by the Centers for Disease Control. And our numbers have remained, relatively low in terms of, who's in the hospital. But with the last couple of weeks, we've seen a doubling of sort of the rate of admissions for people with COVID. So, we have to get it together. I mean, we have to really be willing to go ahead, put back in those fairly simple, straightforward steps, get our masks back on when we're indoors so we avoid that kind of transmission, get tested if we're sick or had an exposure or we're gathering with others indoors. Go ahead, get vaccinated, get boosted. If it's been more than 5 months, you need that booster dose. That's for everybody who's vaccine eligible at the point. And then, by all means, if you're sick, please don't go out and about and take chances at infecting others.
But I think most people, when they see no mandates, I know it's to protect the hospital system primarily, but when people see no indoor mask mandates, they think the message is this pandemic is largely behind us.
Yeah. I think that's unfortunate. Right? I think that's unfortunate, but I do agree that, when something's required, people tend to take that step more seriously and feel more compelled to do that. We have a strong recommendation in most of our settings. And then, as you know, we still have requirements in our higher risk settings for that very reason. Our hope was that we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have new variants of concern, mutated, strains that, in fact, are highly infectious and easily spread, and that more people by now would have come in to get boosted, get that additional protection. Without it, unfortunately, we do need people to pay more attention to the strong recommendations, not wait for those requirements in the settings that aren't at very high risk. So, on transit, you need to wear your mask, in healthcare facilities, at our nursing homes, at our shelters. But again, if we want to keep transmission lower, we're going to have to put the mask back on when we're indoors. It's just a highly infectious variant, and we all would do well to protect ourselves and each other and all the workers if we kept those masks on. And I know just anecdotally, lots of people you know, are telling us stories that, you know, they're getting sick. It's a reinfection. They already got infected with COVID once, and now they're really troubled by the fact that they're getting reinfected. And also that, you know, particularly with BA.2, BA.2.12.1, it seems like people are saying the illness is not so mild. While a lot of folks don't end up in the hospital, just anecdotally, you know, people are saying, you know, I was pretty sick. I felt really, really miserable. This was not a cold, you know. This wasn't even a bad cold. I couldn't get out of bed. So, you know, again, we need to urge caution. Every time we have a new variant of concern, it takes us a while to understand how it's interacting with our bodies and our community. And during that time period, if you've got a lot of transmission, people just need to be cautious.
But I guess I'm wondering, what more can public health do? What more can your agency do to get the message out if you're strongly advising, but people are just shrugging their shoulders and acting as if the pandemic is over and spreading the virus? Then shouldn't you consider reimposing a mandate or talking about reimposing a mandate just to get people's attention?
Yeah, I mean, we will reimpose the mandate when we go to high community level. And, you know, there's 150 communities, you know, counties across the United States that move to high. So that's completely plausible for us to move there if we're not careful.
When do you expect that to happen?
I don't want it to happen, so I'm hoping it doesn't happen. So I have no expectation for when it will happen. I think we still have a very good chance at not getting there. But people have to be more cautious than they're being, particularly as we go into another holiday weekend. There's no reason for us to go there.
Yeah, but when you look at New York, New York's at high, and they're usually a couple weeks ahead of us when it comes to this virus.
That's the worrisome trend, is New York has slipped into high. Boston's at high. Philly's at high. Berkeley reimposed a masking mandate for students because they were seeing too much spread at their schools. So I don't think anybody should take this lightly. We don't need to get ourselves into a more dangerous situation before people take some sensible steps.
What do you recommend people to do in their daily lives? Would you eat inside a restaurant now, for example? Would you reconsider a leisure vacation?
Yeah, I think it depends on who you are and what your risk factors are and what your tolerance is for that risk. Clearly, for people who are relatively healthy, relatively young, fully vaxxed, fully boosted, eating indoors in a place that's well ventilated may be an activity that feels appropriate for them. I think for older people, people with underlying health conditions, people who live with people who are vulnerable at much higher risk, you know, you probably want to keep your restaurant meals outdoors still, just to reduce your risks. And, you know, I think the other thing is, it's sort of cumulative risk. Like, how many places do you want to go where you're increasing your risks because you're not going to be able to wear a mask? I think all of us, wherever we can, should keep those masks on when we're indoors. And that really does reduce your personal risk a lot. So when you say, you know, people want to travel, I think, you know, absolutely. But be mindful of the need to keep your mask on, keep your distance, wash your hands, use hand sanitizer, and limit the times you're going to be indoors with people who aren't masked. And I think that's just sensible. There's no need to just say, I'm not going to do anything for most people. I think, you know, there's a small number of people that are at extraordinarily high risk, and they're going to have to reassess whenever we get to these points where we have high transmission, which activities they want to go ahead and do. And, you know, for people who are at that very high risk level, you know, they're going to rethink what gatherings they want to go to, especially if those are going to be indoors, and try to limit that, because you just need to limit the chances. But it is better if the people around you are also wearing their mask, especially when, you know, we've got such an infectious set of variants circulating.
Right, so I'm just wondering, what's preventing you from doing that? Like, why wouldn't you do it? I know it has to do with hospitalizations, but from what you just told me, you think it'd be better for the businesses and better for the community at large if there were mask mandates?
Well, you know, if there was consensus on what's better for everyone, it gets it's easier for us to move in. I think there is a reality to times have changed. We've got vaccinations, we've got boosters, we've got therapeutics, and we've got testing and ample supply. And we have high quality masks and ample supply. So I understand, you know, those residents, those businesses that feel like we should, you know, clearly message how important it is to do these things. And then when we're not in a dangerous situation, you know, allow people to exercise that judgment. I just think the problem with that is, A, it penalizes those people at highest risk always. And B, if folks aren't really using good judgment and aren't really willing to continue taking steps to protect other people, you end up back in a dangerous situation that was avoidable. But I think it's attention. And, you know, I think CDC tried to address that with setting these community levels that, you know, were an effort to acknowledge we're not going to wait until hospitals are, like, overstressed before we declare that additional steps need to be taken in local communities. But we are going to tie it less to a metric that talks about transmission and more to one that acknowledges that with the new tools, we have less severe illness circulating. And that's true.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks a lot.
That's LA County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer. All right, we are going to take a quick break before we finish the program or get on with the program and bring you all the great stuff we have planned for you today to get you to go to the phone or go online at kcrw.com/give and become a member. This is the second to last day of our spring membership drive. So for all you procrastinators out there, this is the time to do it. kcrw.com/give 800-600-KCRW. Hey, you know why you love KCRW. You're here now. You're listening to me talk instead of doing whatever else you could be doing. And you do it because you want to hear the rest of the program, because you are addicted to KCRW, be it the news, be it the music, be it the culture programs, be it the live events that we produce, all the newsletters that you get giving you a heads up on what's happening in your community. We are the glue that knits you to your greater community, and we need you to be part of that glue. Be with us. Stick with us. I'm going to extend this whole metaphor as much as I can. 800-600-5279, kcrw.com/give. That's where you go to do it. Any amount gets you in, but we're suggesting $20 a month. If you can swing that, we would really, really appreciate it. We cannot do it without you. And I know I've said that a lot, but it is true. kcrw.com/give 800-600-5279. Thank you to everyone who has given, and thank you to you for making that decision to do the same. Coming up, how to have a garden that doesn't die as we cut back on watering. We'll tell you about the silver lining of this drought we're in next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A dire warning from the governor yesterday. He says Californians could face mandatory water restrictions later this summer if conservation efforts don't improve, voluntary conservation efforts. He's already called for a 15% reduction, which has not happened. Here in Southern California, starting next week, around 6 million people in LA, Ventura, and San Bernardino counties will be restricted to one day a week watering. The rest of LA is already restricted to watering just 2 days a week for only 8 minutes at a time. We're going to talk about what this means for our gardens, our lawns, and our yards with Evan Meyer. He's the executive director of the Theodore Payne Foundation for Wildflowers and Native Plants. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you promote natives and wildflowers that can presumably tolerate heat in our Southern California existence. What are the best plants to do that?
Well, the best plants for tolerating heat and also surviving with little water are the plants that grow wild wherever you are. So that's actually quite variable depending on where you are in Southern California. So if you're in Santa Monica, there's going to be a certain set of plants that thrive there. If you're here in Sun Valley, which is much hotter where we are, there's a different set of plants that will thrive there. So it really depends exactly where you are on what the best choice is going to be for you.
Right. Well, one thing that all of us can't really keep alive at this moment is a big green lawn, right?
Yeah. Lawns are very water hungry. They're typically watered multiple times per week. And they just probably at this point are not appropriate in most situations. And here at Theodore Payne Foundation, we actually view this as a good thing because it's going to get rid of lawns, which they take a lot of water, but they also don't provide much for wildlife. They're kind of sterile in a way. And we can replace that with native plants and low water plants that both save water, but also can build habitats and create ecological systems in our urban and suburban spaces that will bring butterflies and hummingbirds and lizards into home gardens and municipal spaces alike. So it's not all bad. There's actually a good opportunity here to rethink the landscape.
And can you keep those plants alive on a 2-day-a-week, 8-minute-a-time watering schedule?
You can, but there is some nuance to that. So one thing I would not recommend is trying to install a lot of plants now or anytime really before the rainy season, because the establishment phase of new plants is when they're going to need the most water. So that should really be timed with the rainy season. So hopefully you're getting rain that will actually kind of water the plants in, and you can supplement that with the water that is allowed. And then there's also hand watering. So when you're establishing plants, hand watering is going to be a really good way to make sure that you're targeting your water to the specific plants that you're getting established. And if you establish them correctly and you pick the right plants and you really encourage deep root growth, they can absolutely withstand the amount of water that's being allocated for home use.
Like, what if you want to plant fruit trees? Is that a no-no?
Well, fruit trees typically do take more water. But this kind of gets into an interesting point that trees are really being exempted from a lot of these restrictions because they provide a lot of other benefits, such as cooling down the city, providing shade. But hand watering is always a really good way to go, and making sure that you do like a deep, infrequent water on the trees so you don't have to water them, you know, every day or even every week necessarily. It's going to be maybe every couple of weeks for most trees, and you're really targeting a deep watering to make sure that the trees survive, because if all the trees were to die, that would be a really bad outcome. It would make the city so much hotter. There'd be no shade anywhere. So I think it's really important that folks keep their trees alive as we head into these water restrictions.
And did you say they're exempted from these drought rules?
So my understanding is that trees will be exempted from these restrictions for certain types of watering, including hand watering. And the time that those trees are watered is important as well. So they don't want anyone watering during the heat of the day, which makes a lot of sense because a lot of that water is going to evaporate. And it's also kind of unhealthy for trees because it can cause root pathogens to proliferate. So they're asking to water in the evening or in the early morning. Again, that will be a slow, deep watering for trees to keep them alive.
Right. Because that would set up another vicious cycle, right? Because they absorb some of the carbon dioxide. So if you don't have trees around, well, that just exacerbates climate change.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things that can go wrong in trying to solve this problem. So during the last drought, it wasn't a particularly nuanced message that happened, and people people just sort of removed a lot of lawns and kind of went willy-nilly with it, and a lot of gravel went down. And mm-hmm. if you think about, you know, what it's like to stand in a gravel yard, I don't know if you've ever stood in a gravel yard before, but it's hot.
I have some gravel in my yard, I have to admit.
If you go out and stand there, you know, at noon on a hot summer day, it's actually going to be quite a bit warmer than a landscape that has mulch and shrubs. So we really advocate for not going the gravel route in mass. I mean, it's fine to use in certain situations, but if you're removing a whole lawn rather than covering that with gravel, which is going to just make your house so much hotter, and then you're going to have to use more energy to cool your house, rather than doing that, doing a very well designed and well planted landscape that is primarily native plants with some Mediterranean climate, drought tolerant plants, and plants that are going to be adapted to take most of their water in the wintertime. So that's going to include almost all the native plants of California, as well as many plants from other parts of the world that also come from a similar climate to ours.
Where do we find out more about these plants and what we should plant for our neighborhoods?
Well, I would say the one of the best things you can do is come to our nursery here at Theodore Payne Foundation, where each plant has a placard with very detailed information, including how much water it's going to take. There's also a really great website called calscape.org. Plant material is wonderful. Artemisia Nursery is wonderful. And those nurseries specialize in native plants. So you can go there and talk to the folks there and learn about native plants and how to use them in your garden.
Evan Meyer is the executive director of the Theodore Payne Foundation for Wildflowers and Native Plants in Sun Valley. Thank you, Evan.
Thanks a lot.
Here's another place you should visit, kcrw.com/give, and become a member or renew your membership today. This is the second to last day of our spring membership drive, so put it off no longer. And we have another added incentive. We have our KCRW board member Eddie Woods and Jan Woods are putting up $25,000 for KCRW, but only if you help us raise the same amount by midnight tonight. So that means 50 grand for us here at KCRW, and we could sure use it. So please do your part, kcrw.com/give. And you do it because you love the combination of news, music, and culture that only KCRW provides. This is a station that people listen to all over the country, all over the world, really. We get members from everywhere saying, gosh, there's nothing like KCRW. So don't take us for granted. It's kind of like water. Like, yeah, sometimes when you turn on the tap, it's always there, but ooh, it is a precious resource. So it's the same thing with KCRW. Yes, we're always here, but we are a precious resource, and it costs money to keep us alive, and you are part of it. So don't rely on other people to do it. If you can do it now, please go online at kcrw.com/give. Pick up all sorts of great thank you gifts, too, while you're there. Coming up, testimony in the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial is ending this week. It has provided a window into what happens when domestic violence is made public.
This is once again the notion of who gets to be believed, only this perfect victim, and that's, you know, that's not something that exists. Mm-hmm.
That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's the final week of testimony in the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial. Heard's attorneys rested their case yesterday. Depp's attorneys are expected to call rebuttal witnesses that include his ex-girlfriend, the model Kate Moss. That kind of star power, on top of the salacious details of the couple's turbulent marriage, have turned this trial into a public spectacle. The jury is expected to get the case on Friday, but in the court of public opinion, the verdict is in. Heard is losing. On social media, the hashtag Justice for Johnny Depp has more than 15 billion views compared to the I Stand With Amber hashtag with about 8.5 million views. So in this era of Me Too, why the unequal support, especially among women? Joining us now is Claire Lampin, who's written about this for The Cut. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right. So there were some really grueling details that Amber Heard revealed in her 4 days on the stand. Physical, emotional, sexual violence. The response on social media was brutal. Can you detail what happened?
Yeah. So I think on social media, and certainly I have been watching the trial on these live streams, and so the sidebar chats that are running are just sort of repopulating vitriol faster than I can read it. You know, it all trends, except for the stray pro-Amber message of support, like it all really trends in one direction. People just seeming really, really unwilling to listen to her, really quick to turn her into a punchline. A lot of cruelty, I think, mm-hmm. is probably the shortest way to say it.
Right. Well, she hasn't come across great either, to be honest. So, you know, she has admitted to hitting him. They have mm-hmm. both said incredibly horrible things to each other. It seemed like a really awful marriage. So is some of this deserved, this reaction?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is sort of the subtext of a lot of what I'm seeing from other viewers, because she strikes them as unlikable, or because, you know, she has admitted to hitting Depp. To calling him really ugly names, that she was either complicit in any violence that went on or deserved it or was solely responsible for it. And one thing I've thought about a lot in covering this trial is sort of how much it reflects myths and misunderstandings about domestic violence and intimate partner violence. Is pushing someone the same thing as pushing them back because you have been pushed? Is it the same as self-defense? Yeah, I mean, we've only heard from one domestic violence expert in this trial. Maybe, you know, there has not been enough unpacking of what that cycle of abuse looks like and what that inherent sort of power imbalance looks like. This is once again, the notion of who gets to be believed, only this perfect victim. And that's, you know, that's not something that exists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think there's an expectation of that people reporting domestic abuse claims behaved passively and never fought back. And that's simply not a reflection of reality.
Mm.
It seems plausible to me that if you're living inside of that cycle, that you would sometimes fight back, whether that's verbally or physically. You know, what matters is who is instigating within this like broader pattern of behavior. Heard does not come across as totally innocent. But I think that she's also presented evidence that does suggest that, you know, there is some validity to the claims that she's making. Setting aside the fact or the question of whether or not a person believes her, to me, that's sort of almost secondary to the fact that so many people seem to have determined not even to hear her.
Mm.
And that is troubling to me.
Right. And so that's when you look at the, I guess, the unequal support on social media, even though they both are accused and have admitted to really shocking behavior. It seems
right.
that the in the court of public opinion online, it seems like only one person is more guilty of that.
Right. And that's sort of the baffling thing to me about this as well, is like, okay, on the one hand, Amber Heard has admitted to some pretty ugly behaviors, but like there's also some pretty bad evidence that we've heard about Johnny Depp, like the texts, all these recordings, like why doesn't it make a dent on his side? And, you know, these are not questions that I can really answer mm-hmm. on my own, but I do think it's also relevant that, you know, there's a really committed fanship driving a lot of this and sort of planting the seed online and then therefore driving the tone.
And then how much of that is bots too? Like I've also read that he's been able to employ a lot of like a very advanced social media strategy his team has.
Yeah. I mean, I can't confirm that or not, but I have heard the same thing, and you know, it's staggering the response online.
Right. And so I guess let's just take the bot question out of it and assume that the public is more on his side. Why do you think that mm-hmm. is? And here's a guy who's pretty much a washed up actor. He's been accused of some pretty violent things. He has an ad- you know, what looks like a pretty serious substance abuse problem, and which may have contributed to all of this. So why so much support for him?
Well, I mean, I think before he got to this point, he was just very widely respected and I think regarded as this enormous talent, very attractive, very charming, really easy to like. And his characters often skew the same way. So not a psychologist, but maybe it's easier to latch on to the roles someone is playing and, you know, sort of valorize them. Mm-hmm. But I also think there's like the valorization of Johnny Depp on the one hand, and who knows if how this would play out if it were someone else who's accusing him. But I imagine we would see some of the same sorts of tropes that we always see when someone comes forward and accuses a powerful person of sexual abuse, or, you know, even not a powerful person. There's always a contingent that seems really ready to discredit the survivor. You know, it's the same sort of questions over and over again, like, what were you wearing? Were you drinking? Were you doing drugs? What did you say or do to prompt a person to act this way or make them think that they could? I guess for me, some of this is a reminder that, you know, that line of thinking is still very much alive and well.
Mm. So the Me Too movement was a flash in the pan? Would you go that way?
No, that's not what I'm saying. And okay. I'm not preferred to say this is a referendum on Me Too. What I am getting from this is that intimate partner violence and domestic violence have not received sort of the same amount of attention over the past 5 years as, you know, like a lot of the stories attached to Me Too are, there are lessons to be learned from them about the way that power has helped enable and also cover up sexual misconduct. You know, it's usually been in an industry context or in professional context. And I don't know that domestic violence and IPV have gotten the same sort of consideration. Mm-hmm. So the myths and misconceptions about people who find themselves in those sorts of relationships are really persistent here. Like, yeah. Why didn't she leave if it was really that bad is commentary that I just keep seeing all over the place.
Right. And so do you think that this will inhibit, I mean, you can't really know, I guess, but other victims of domestic violence from coming forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be really hard to watch this trial just full stop. It's not a stretch of the imagination for me to imagine that that would have a chilling effect. But I also think that a lot of this trial has actually gotten away from the central question of defamation.
Right. I guess they're trying to prove the underpinnings of whether or not she was telling the truth about he being an abuser, but she never named him in that op-ed.
Yeah. And I think it's sort of difficult to say that it was that op-ed and not, you know, any of the other coverage that contributed to the downfall of his career, the downward trend in his career.
Yeah, it's hard to tease that out for sure. Well, Claire, thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. That's Claire Lampin, staff writer at The Cut. And you are listening to KCRW in our second to last day of our spring membership drive. So go ahead and go on over to kcrw.com/give and re-up your membership or become a sustaining member. We'd love it if you could become a sustaining member at about $20 a month if you can sustain that. Think of all the other things you sustain every month that you have to buy. You don't get the product without paying for it. All of your subscriptions and your Spotify, your cable, your daily coffee, whatever it is, you're probably spending more than $20 a month on it and not getting as much satisfaction, let's be honest. So give what you can at kcrw.com/give. We really rely on you and we need you to get in before the deadline. So thank you for that. Coming up, Bobby Brown wasn't just the husband of Whitney Houston. He had a big musical career. Now he's the subject of a docuseries. We're going to talk about him next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for TV on the radio. And today, a blast from the past. The summer of 1983, a boy band named New Edition was number one on the R&B Billboard chart with a song called Candy Girl. The group was led by Bobby Brown, who at the time was just 14 and looking for a way out of the Boston housing project he lived in. He found it with New Edition and then a hugely successful solo career. Well, Bobby Brown's life and career are what tabloid headlines are made for, from his marriage to Whitney Houston, to a string of arrests, to the tragic deaths of two of his children. A&E teamed up with Bobby Brown to tell his life story, which includes the debut of his new reality show, Bobby Brown, Every Little Step. All of that comes out on Memorial Day. Joining us to talk about Bobby Brown is former LA Times music writer Garrett Kennedy and author of the book, Didn't We Almost Have It All, in defense of Whitney Houston. Garrick, welcome to Press Play.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, Bobby Brown was always painted in the media as a bad boy and known mainly as Whitney Houston's partner. How would you describe Bobby Brown?
I think the rightful description of Bobby Brown is, you know, he is someone who helped innovate a moment in R&B that still matters to this day. And, you know, I think so much of around how we speak of him has unfortunately been rooted in his personal life. And I haven't always found that to be entirely fair, considering, you know, what he accomplished on his own, both with New Edition and also with his solo career. So, I mean, you know, Whitney Houston spent a lot of time making sure to remind us that he was the king of R&B, and it's true. That's the perfect way to describe him.
Tell us a little bit about how he became the king of R&B. I mean, when he was in New Edition, he was just a child.
Yeah, one thing that gets kind of lost in the story of Bobby and New Edition and especially the beginning of their story is the fact that, you know, they really did give us the blueprint for the modern boy band. You know, Maurice Starr, he went on to create New Kids on the Block. That was a little bit more successful, but the blueprint was started with, you know, these young boys in Boston. And I think that's really special. It's really special to see the smart idea, which was, let's have these young Black kids do, you know, bubblegum pop and also just a slight hint of hip hop. And it took off. You know, where Bobby really struck gold was, you know, Don't Be Cruel, which, you know, that is an album that is, you know, really a ground zero of creating New Jack Swing, which is an era of R&B that really kind of set the pace for the next 15 years of the genre. And he was a part of that with that album.
But he did that on his own. Did he have to leave New Edition to carve that out?
The leaving New Edition is not exactly what Bobby wanted. He was kicked out of the group. and, you know, it's a very famous story of just, you know, these were young men who came of age together, but also these were young men who never had any money. And now they got money. And with that came a lot of vices. And, you know, Bobby has been very transparent about his vices and how that has impacted both his relationship, you know, with his group members, but also his own life. But, you know, in the beginning, it was, you know, sort of the classic case of people start arguing about money and people showing up late or, you know, beef between members. And it did explode with, you know, a very famous group meeting and Bobby being booted and Bobby, you know, going out on his own and striking gold there. But yeah, he was kicked out of the group. Part of him being kicked out obviously led to his own hunger to make it on his own.
Yeah, which he did. And he did really young, right? And he became a huge star when he was still a teenager. And in the documentary, he talks about driving around a city in which he's performing and he sees someone with a car that he likes, he buys it immediately, drives it around that day and just leaves it. Like, he had so much money.
Yeah. And I mean, just even something like that is like, you think of what it's like to come from literally nothing to even just like, you know, New Edition's like their first tour. They're these kids. They had just done all this stuff. They had this humongous hit. They're playing all these, you know, sold out shows, and they come back to the same hood that they left. And their check was like $2. I mean, it was insane sort of what they had gone through. So you can see sort of what Bobby was dealing with when he was on his own, where it's like you are having a bunch of money that you don't know what to do with, and you have this access and this power and all of these things, and it's the 80s, and I mean, just it really was the perfect stage for this other image that we came to know, which was him as a bad boy.
Right. So talk about how he created his music, because he had producers who helped write his songs and or did write his songs. How much of it was him?
I think the idea around ownership and crafting music, I think sometimes our idea of it is very different. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes when you say, okay, well, did somebody write the song themselves? Not necessarily. Vocal producing, however, is a completely entirely different skill. The way a song is going to be sung. So that is what someone like Bobby is doing. That's what somebody like Whitney was doing. These are artists mm-hmm. who they did not get a particular type of credit because they were not someone who was going in the studio and writing every lyric and producing every beat. There's this idea that he really played no role. Part of what made Bobby a sensation as a solo artist, but also as a member of New Edition, really is his swag. I mean, it's the way that he is going to sing. It's the way that he was bringing sort of this world of like old traditional showmanship with also the swagger that was coming out of rap. And so him marrying those two was part of really the magic. And so, yeah, he might not have been writing every single note, but the way these songs were sang, the way these songs were interpreted, that was all Bobby.
Interesting. Yeah, so he would take his shirt off all the time on stage. The women in the audience would swoon. And then he would bring up a woman in every performance up on stage, and they would have this kind of mock romance on stage, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's, in retrospect, it's quite boring. But the reality of when Bobby was doing this was at a time that, Black men were not allowed to be sexual. But there was something about, oh, what you're doing is salacious. Oh, what you're doing is raunchy. Oh, what you're doing is against the law, which actually is something that happened. He was arrested for indecency on stage. But the thing that was so interesting about those performances is you look at Elvis and it was the same thing. Mm-hmm. You look at Mick Jagger, it was the same thing. But they weren't getting arrested for it. And, I don't have to say why that is, but the fact that it's still sort of how he's seen does play a role in this image that has continued to exist.
And how did he and Whitney Houston meet and fall in love?
They met at the Soul Train Awards. I mean, the story has been told a million times at this point. They met at the Soul Train Awards. He was obviously at his solo height. She was sitting in the row behind him. She bumped into his seat on purpose. That was a way to say hello. It was sort of a really instant, swift romance, which both Bobby and Whitney in 88, I mean, they were two of the most beautiful people on the planet. So it really was no surprise that they got together and that it was as hot as it was, as chaotic as it was, all of the things, just based off of who they were at those times in their lives. And they were young people finding their footing in the industry.
He's already a huge star. She becomes a mega huge star. How did he handle her stardom?
I think there's different ways. What we saw was someone who struggled with the attention, was struggled with sort of the being cast as, Mr. Whitney Houston, someone who acted out for her attention, for our attention. But, I've had a lot of reflection about it, obviously, working on the book, my book for, 4 years, but also reading Bobby's book. And there was a really interesting thing that I never really thought about, how we looked at him. And we immediately saw this person who was inferior to her. You think back to the coverage around when they got together. And I mean, there was people who were wondering, well, why won't you just accept Robert De Niro's phone call? Because he was courting her at the time. No one cared about the fact that Robert De Niro was old enough to be her grandfather. No one cared about the fact that Robert De Niro had a wife, but they loved the fact that this, Hollywood giant was courting Whitney Houston. So why aren't you going in that direction? Why aren't you going to Eddie Murphy? Why are you going over here to the stub? And the second that things started to go left, we blamed him, and we did it for the next 20 years.
Yeah. How much of that though was justified, do you think, in all the research that you've done?
I mean, I think a lot of it has to come off the table when we find out after Whitney dies, right? So you think of how long that was. They get married in what, early 90s, 94? We find out after she dies that he did not introduce her to hard drugs. He would have not been able to say, well, I mean, yeah, we're doing drugs together, but like I was only doing these drugs first and then she introduced me to this and now we do them together. No one would have actually cared. The only thing that people would have said is, oh, how dare you bring her down? So instead, he took those bullets. And I do think it did contribute to his own addictions and his own struggles. One of the biggest interviews after Whitney died was her mother sitting with Oprah and telling us the reality there. Mm-hmm. Her brother sitting right there and being like, no, it was us.
You know, your mother writes in her book about how you were doing drugs with your sister. I was shocked and hurt and confused. I didn't understand it then, and I still don't. How does it feel to hear your mother say that?
It's painful. Mm-hmm. I feel responsible for it. I let it go so far. Mm-hmm. You know, we were always, like you said, being together. And everything that you do together as you're growing up, and then when you get into drugs, you do that together too. And it just got out of hand.
So the fact that we're not seeing, you know, any of her family members say anything different until after she was gone, I think that was awful. I mean, there's just no other way to say it other than that. But I also extend a lot of grace for the fact of, you know, there was probably a lot of protection that was happening. Mm. Now, in terms of justifying how much of her downfall we have to attribute to him, yeah, I'm not going to sit here and say that we can't give him some of that. But I'm going to say a thing that's really unpopular. The truth of the matter is Bobby's the only one that's still alive. I'm not saying give
or
him
he
credit,
was lucky,
but we do have to give some consideration to that. Yeah, there's luck, but also like if we're being real, when it comes to like hardcore drug use, how much luck is there? You know, the luck does run out at some point, right? Yeah. And it's run out for him before. He has had overdoses. He has had these moments where it's been life or death for him. When is the last time that we've seen Bobby in the news for a legal issue? It's been a long time. Mm-hmm. But every time we talk about him, we still talk about his legal issues from the 90s. Do we or do we not? Right. You know, every time we discuss him, we want to talk about drugs. Do we or do we not? So at a certain point, I think we are not allowing him to move on, which I think some of these books or these documentaries is part of what he's trying to do. But there's also the reality that there are going to be people who will never let him live a life that does not include revisiting that every time we talk about him or to him.
Right. But then when his kids die. I mean, the latest Bobby Brown Jr. died just last year of a drug overdose. It just brings it all back.
It brings it all back, but I like to challenge that too, because we know too much about addiction. Right. We know too much about how it's genetic. We know far too much to do this thing of, well, oh no, but his kids, if they had the same thing, and so let's talk about him again. It's like, well, yeah, he's not shied away from the fact that he had an addiction. We know. So is it that big of a stretch that his children struggle with it also? Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think that's where it starts to feel actually unfair to me, because we don't do this with other celebrities who have had similar tragedies. We give them a lot of compassion, but we still don't really extend that to Bobby. And I've always really struggled with that. But I think only seeing him in terms of these tragedies, while it's understandable, because, you know, that is your ex-wife, you know, two of your children, those are humongous traumatic events. But I also think about how we don't talk about the fact that Bobby has shown us sobriety. He has shown us, I am a person who has a lot of traumas and I am trying to move forward. You know, I saw him in New Edition a couple of months ago, and this is the first time that all six of the members performed together. And I think of how big that is for Bobby to be able to be at this point in his career and go back to this group that kicked him out, you know, and to have this next act where he's able to, you know, exist in this space and have some distance from the things that did define him, which is a lot of tragedy. And I wonder, you know, at what point do we move beyond it?
I guess I just want to ask you about his position then as a musician in the history of R&B and where he fits in it. Where do you see him as fitting in, you know, his legacy and his influence, even given the fact that we do spend all this time talking about his personal life?
I think Bobby's legacy within R&B has never actually changed. People who study the genre, who revere the genre, they will always be able to tell you Bobby's place. Having that conversation to the rest of the world, I don't really know how many of them care. Mm-hmm. Because it's the same thing that we're seeing right now with Janet Jackson. we are having to constantly remind the world of, well, she created these sounds in R&B. So like, because we saw her nipple for, you know, 9/16 of a second, we just say, oh, she doesn't matter. That's what we do to Black artists in this country. And so I do think there's where he resides in Black America, who's going to always understand his importance in the genre. And then there's the rest of the world where we have to still talk about him and Whitney and him and drugs, you know, and that's just, it's just the hard truth of it.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Garrett Kennedy. His book is Didn't We Almost Have It All? In Defense of Whitney Houston. The A&E biography on Bobby Brown debuts on Monday. The reality show, Bobby Brown, Every Little Step, debuts on Tuesday. All right, take a little step to KCRW.com/give and become a member of KCRW to support the kinds of conversations that you don't hear anywhere else. And the music and the cultural programming and the live events and everything else you get from this radio station. It is truly unique and we rely on you. So please do your part at KCRW.com/give. We have one more day of the spring membership drive, so get in now. Get in while you can. KCRW.com/give. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I will see you tomorrow.